accession number 20259, Reel 2.
Jim Benz, Reel 2.
Yeah, we got punished for getting ringworm because they said it was because we'd been using pillars for pillar fights and we got the different pillars and it spreads round and that sort of thing. I think the only time that I ever had anybody that was kind to me and really genuinely sorry for me is when I got measles. Well, I didn't know that what it was measles. I know I wasn't very well, and they put me in a separate room, and I think there was about six all in the beds. They had six beds in there, one, two each. And the curtains had to be drawn all the time, so there was no sunlight coming in or things like that. And it was the first time that I'd ever had bread and milk. They used to have some older girls that worked there, but they worked in the laundry and they worked in the needle room and things like that. These were girls that, whether they come from another convent or whether they were young girls that had come into the convent to work for, you know, a wage or something, I don't know. But so many of them we used to do looking after people who were ill, you know, and they used to give us bread and milk and ever so quite, you know, just go to sleep and this, that and the other. And I remember one of them used to sing us a song. I can't remember what it was, something about the sun today and the sun tomorrow or something. I can't remember what it went like, you know. And of course we didn't have to go down to benediction, we didn't have to go to mass and sort of things, even though we just stayed in bed. The only time we got out is when we had to go to the loos and things, you know. But
so I think you were going to tell me how you came to leave Morecambe.
Well, the idea of the thing of leaving Morecambe is that I was spent my time to firelighters and this, that, and the other, and other boys down there, you know, they've got young mums and wanting, and they've got their dads and they're out in the war. Well, I couldn't say that my dad was in the war because I was living with him, and he was 63 something then, and so, you know, I didn't what do you call it. At the bottom of the row of houses that we lived in was a man who had a wood yard, and he used to chop wood up for firelighters. Well, he never did take to me, you know. He used to, you know, go. I used to kind of look through the gate and see him sitting there chopping wood all the time. And he'd got his son was lived in the first house because the yard was back round to the railway. And of course, he got all these sort of toys like toy tanks and toy guns and things, you know, which sometimes he let me play with them. But this lot used to chase me away every time he used to come out of his wood yard to come home for a cup of tea or whatever it was. But then it was because it was lately that I found out why. Because Mrs. Baines was in competition with him. He's selling firewood and she's selling firelighters. Because then they daffed me. I didn't think that way, you know. And of course he got all these toys, didn't he? And then there was other ones, you know, across the road. There was a little girl called Elaine and her mother, and she used to smoke, you know, which outside, which you know, women didn't really smoke outside, did they, you know. She used to smoke outside, but her husband, they were saying, oh, you know, that poor Mrs. what you call it, her husband is a prisoner of war with the Japs. You see, well, you know, Japs, Germans and so on. You know, they didn't really come a lot to me, you know. I know the war was on, sort of thing, but you know, everything carried on the same as it does every day. You know, the only time that anything big difference when a whole lot of Americans come through to go to the railway station and things like that. You know, kids would tell each other, "Yanks are coming," or Brits, you know, and you go up there and sort of thing is you follow the other lads, you know, carry your kit bag, Yank, and sort of things, and you know, get some chewing gum, any gum, and you know, older girls would, I mean, be asking for nylons or something like that. And anyway, life seemed to be different for me to what it is all to all the rest. Well, we used to go on a Sunday, because we used to have to go to church every morning, even with Mr. and Mrs. Baines, church every morning, and the priest there was a Father Clayton. And of course I had to go then, and that's where I started to learn Latin, to be an altar boy. And sort of thing, and then after church we'd walk up to the front, the prom at the front, and walk them down the prom and then come back and sort of thing. Because you couldn't do anything on a Sunday. I could go through my Latin lessons with my little book and one thing and another, but there was no work, no nothing, you know, because it's God's day and sort of things. And if you didn't know what to do or what not, you can always go back to church and kneel down and pray, sort of thing, you know, don't waste the day. And anyway, I knew my way up to the prom, so sometimes I used to nip out and I'd go up to the prom and some of the lads that I knew round about, sort of thing, because they hadn't got dads to control them and mums are busy, you know, doing this, that and the other sort of thing. They used to go. Well, the thing is, a lot of the prom was marked off, you know, because of invasion piers and things like that, and sort of things. And another good place we used to go to was Heysham Head, which is, you know, it was a long walk for kids of my age, but I mean, walking, well, never had a, the only time I ever went on a bus was coming from Carlisle down to Morecambe. And I remember coming down there, and I got there, it was 10 o'clock at night when she put the key in the door, and we walked in, and I had to wait there till they struck the match and to light the gas mantle that's in there, because they didn't have electric. But the funny thing was that they had a radio, which was radio relay, and of course the wire, so that must have carried the electric from wherever the thing was. Certainly wasn't on the house. Well, they didn't have any mains in the house. It was all gas. And that was my introduction to them. As I say, I found that we walked everywhere, because I walked up and down with the firelighters and go miles and this, that and the other, so I was used to walking. And we used to go up to Heysham Head. Well, if there was a dogfight on, if there was something happening over there, you know, the bombers are coming. This is night time, of course, you know, because you can hear the planes on the way, you know, miles before they get there. They'd go and, you know, knock on the door and stand coming out and sort of thing, you know, up to Heysham Head. Creep through all the barbed wires to get right on the coast so you can look over the cliffs, you see, to see the sort of thing, what was going on. And then one day, or one night, I was in there. Well, it was about the third time that I'd been up there. And there was such a bang and my head was this, you know, pounding and one thing and another. And so was Stans. And what had happened, it was the ARP man had come up and followed this. Because somebody must have said, you know, there's something happening here because they've got tracks running through and underneath the barbed wire. See, because there was single coiled barbed wire. And they could see this and so he'd been told to keep an eye out for something. And he'd come up with all this noise going on, one thing. And what he'd done, he'd banged our heads together, and that was a pain, you know, daddy, because we were only little, you know, lightweight kids, and dragged us back there, threw us out, and that, we're going to find out where you live, and all this, that, and the other. Anyway, we started running, and that was it. He couldn't go, because, you know, he couldn't go chasing us to find out where we were going, because there could be some Jerry's coming in or something. He had to stay on his post.
Can you tell me how you came to be in the army then, please?
Well, I was going to tell you about Morecambe, and say we got fed up with this, but one of the boys had told me that the land over there was France, you see? And he said, if you go down to the seashores there, well, it's all them boats, you know, you can get the boat and you can... Well, I did. I got one of the fishermen's boats, and the tide was coming in, managed to get it turned around. I started running. Well, I mean, it was a great big boat to me, and I knew how to do the oars, you know, because I mean, you know, sat down and played on them and seen the fishermen go. Anyway, I only got about two or three stone, I lost one oar, and then we caught the other one. I tried to do that and was going down the circle, but Some of the fishermen came out and grabbed hold of me and brought me back and took me to the police station. And I got to know where I lived. And I said, number 8 Pine Street. And they said, you're not from round here, are you? I said, yes. I live with my mother and father at number 8 Pine Street. And they couldn't work me out, sort of thing, you know. Where do you live? That's where you live? Yes, all right. So anyway, they brought this Mr. and Mrs. Baines up. And of course, when they saw them, they thought, well, there's no way that this is your child. It must be your grandchild. This, that and the other. And Mrs. Baines had said, had a talk with him and this, that and the other, and sort of thing. Then we came out of there and we marched all the way down to the front and all the way up to West End, because we used to go that way to go to Morecambe. And then it suddenly stopped at a house, 53 Norfolk Avenue, and left me there. And Mrs. Baines went inside, she was talking to this woman in there, and natter, and sort of things. And she came and she put a chair out there and she said, you sit there, and stop there. And Mr. and Mrs. Baines went off. And then, you know, how many hours later, or after the shift, or the end of the working day, or something like that, this man came up to me. And he says, he started chatting and wanting, and that was my father, James William Baines. And this lady who was with him was Mrs. Longmire, and she had a son, you know, about 13 or 14, something like that. And sort of thing. But I'm still in touch with Dougie and Alan, my stepmother, because they had a baby. My father and Mrs. Longmire, he got married, and they had my son. Yeah. Right.
How does this connect with you joining the army then?
About 2 days after stopping at this at this house in Norfolk Avenue, a lady and gentleman came over, also called Mr. and Mrs. Baines, and he was called Walter Baines, and he was my father's brother, which is my uncle, and Alice, his wife, Auntie Alice, and they came to take me to Leeds. Because I couldn't stop with my father and his other wife and the others. They hadn't got the room and all this and the other. So I came and he said that he'd come over to pick me up. I was going to go and live in Leeds and he was going to adopt me. And he always said he was going to adopt me, but he never did. And I went to live with them at Leeds, at Belle Isle, Leeds. And I went to Hunslet Carr School at the bottom, and I think I'd be about 12 and a half, and I should have left school the following March. I was 14, but they let me go on the Christmas break, so I left school at the Christmas time. Whether there's any records that they keep them or how they could get away with it, I don't know, but it was by then the war had ended. Yeah. The war had ended back then, you see, so I was into Leeds, and of course it was all hands to the pumps again, wasn't it, you know, for workers and one thing and another. And I went to be an apprenticed glass maker, the job I was going to be taught was going to be glass silvering, which the prerogative of the man who does the silvering and whatnot is he's got the formula to make the silver. You know, and sort of things. The only thing I was allowed to do was to make the shellac for painting the back of the silver upon the mirrors. And of course, I didn't settle down with them. You know, I wanted to be out, different lads and sort of things and one thing or another. And Walter said to me, he says, right, because I kept leaving there. I don't know whether I was heading back to Morecambe or where I was heading, you know. What I'd do, I'd wake up at, say, 4 o'clock in the morning, I'd go downstairs, I'd put a half a loaf of bread in a bag and some margarine, and off I'd go. You know, I was going, I didn't want to live there anyway. And jots in when Walter says one day, he says that, you know, you always used to be with a lot of lads and one thing and another. I know it's hard for you to live down there. But Walter was another sort of, he was everything. He was a Unitarian, he was a Methodist, he was a Salvationist, he was a whatever sort of religion that was going. Now, Alice was Salvation Army, and she's always been Salvation Army, and she was a Sergeant Major in the Salvation Army, and she joined the Salvation Army because her father, who was gassed in the First World War, had, like so many of them, turned into alcoholic sort of thing, you know, but fathers ruled the families in them days, you know, the mother, granny, was, you had to do what she was told, and Alice had to do, and she got two brothers, all the same. And Alice went into the Salvation Army to kind of rescue these sort of the people on the streets and the drunks and sort of things, you know, bring them into the army at night time so they can have a cup of tea and listen to the band playing things. And she was a genuine Salvation Army woman, but Walter wanted to try the whole sort of things, you know. And we finished up at Baha'i and... So Walter then said one day, you know, let's go down to the Army recruiting office. Or that's where we went. And he said, you know, I think you'd be a lot better with a lot of boys of your own age and sort of things, you know. I can't really... They never had any children of their own and they didn't know much about... bringing children up and sort of things, you know, so, you know, took me down there and I signed on when I was 16.
What conditions did you sign on under?
I signed on, enlisted into the army on 8 and 4, 8 years with the colours and 4 with the reserve. And I went straight into the band. And, when I went in there, I was only a little fella, and they got me some sort of uniform that was near enough my fit, but it had to have the legs cut and the arms cut and sort of things. But I wasn't very big for my age, but of course, you know, I'd never had done any sort of exercise. I hadn't got enough boot to go and all this, that and the other. But the army, from going in at, I think I'd just cleared the 5 foot mark at 16. But then, you know, I've shot up then in the world of Bindi Army, and I'm 5'10" now. So.
Which unit did you join when you joined
there? I joined the Duke of Wellington Regiment, and I was sent to Strental in York, and I went there and got a sort of a uniform, and I moved into a hut with a lot of other boys. I think there'd be maybe 12 to 15 boys there, and sort of after a couple of days settling in and doing the paperwork and signing your name and getting your army pay book and all this and the other, and we had to go over and send the band sergeant, we had to go over to the band practice room. The band sergeant said that because all the other boys had already got their instruments, and he just brought up, he says, give me a case. He says, that's your instrument, and you look after that, and what you call it, and you let nobody else play it, and this, that, and the other. But of course, when I opened it up, it was an E-flat alto sax. You know, and I thought, oh, you know, what have we got here? Actually, I wanted a flute. But my mate Johnny, who was the band boy in there, and he came from Liverpool, and he was about the same age as me. And funny enough, he was brought up as a Catholic as well, but he lived at Bootle. In Liverpool, and he got a flute, but he said, oh no, you know, band sergeant said no, not let anybody else play. But then after a time, of course, you all had different goals, because you know, if you had a saxophone player or a clarinet, so it's a reed instrument, whereas opposed to a brass instrument like a trombone, euphonium and things like that, if you use those, of course, you spoil your lipping for the instrument that you've been going to be taught to play.
How did you take to army discipline?
I liked it. I thought it was great. I mean, I was in there, and at night time there'd be boys there crying, I won't go home, and all this, that, and the other. And sort of thing. Ah, so it was great. I mean, out on they got all these moors at the back that where they do all the training, and there's lots of sheep on there. I know it was boggy, but that didn't worry me. You know, I used to go through there when I come back with my boots were all muddy. I'd just stick them in a pail of water and stick them on the radiator to dry. And the other boys crying. I was, oh, you know, it's great. And I couldn't wait to you know, all these sort of get dressed up and do exercise and those sort of things, you know, because. And PT in the gym, I lapped it up. The only thing was I couldn't run very far because I was a little fat thing.
Yeah. Was there anything you didn't like about the army?
No. I mean, the sergeant majors and whatnot, you know, they do all their shouting on the drill squares and one thing and other. We used to go in one ear out the other. I mean, I'd grown up like that. Didn't worry me, because the other lads would be, you know, nearly break down in tears because being shouted at and this and the other. And of course, fighting didn't worry me at all, because that was another thing. You know, you fought for everything that you want and wanting and all. So if one lad down there got cocky and challenged you to, you know, try to thump you on. But the thing was, it was a fight between, you worked your way out, because in the dormitories at night time, used to have one lance corporal, used to have a bunk at the top end, and all the rest were just boys. And it'd be down the naffy, you know, with the other bandsmen and one thing and other for the drinks and that. That's when we used to all get together. It used to be one big sort of rough and tumble, you know. And when you hit somebody on the arms, you know, it really hurt and sort of things. But I used to be in the middle of all that lot, and it's great. And it's kind of getting it together. So it wasn't a matter of bullying people as you know, stick up for yourself. I mean, if you didn't stick up for yourself, you'd come off the worst anyway. You know, but then I think it's the sort of thing that it goes on like that. Then you suddenly sit back one day and see the one who's getting bullied the most and you know, and never try and get into it and one thing or another. And then you kind of say, oh, you know, come on, do you want to be on my side? You know, come on my side and sort of thing, you know. And that's how you start learning how to look after your mates and your friends and sort of things. And it's the same with all the different things that go on, you know, bullying and doing your blankoing and all this, that and the other. I mean, it was a piece of cake to me, you know. I'm not bothered about the sergeant shouting and one thing or another, you know. But
did you do weapons training as well?
Yes, after you'd been a band boy, I think you had to come up to somewhere around about 17. Because at 17 and a half, if you wanted, you could transfer over to rifle company. Well, from 17, you'd then go out to tell you about rifle. Well, you had to know about rifle drill. You had to know about rifle drill because of the marching and the bands and the music that all goes with these sort of things, that sort of thing. Everything, you know, about left quick march, you know that pace is exactly the same as what the riflemen are going to do and all this and that. So you go through your marching sequence and everything, and then you get your rifles and you learn weapon training from, as I say, from 17 and sort of thing. The automatic weapons and whatnot are left till later. But then, if you think that you're strong enough and you've got the power to hold a rifle, because it was a 303 rifle, we go down to the range. I mean, we'd already been down to the ranges with 2.2, which is a smaller rifle and a bullet, and there's not much kick to that. But then a 303 has got quite a kick, you know, the first time you ever use them, you know, if you don't pull it into your shoulder. But from then on, I decided to go, that I was going to leave the band and go into a rifle company, because I was a good shot. I was down there on the ranges, and all my shots were in there, you know, and sort of things. And it was all because, you know, knowing how to hold a rifle and sort of things. And then, of course, once you go into infantry training and your rifles, of course, you get your pay on how many stars you get. And you get the top was a 5-star private. The bands, they get stars for being a musician and things like that. You get a 5-star. I believe in olden days you could get to a 6-star private, you know, without any rank at all. But for every star you get extra money. So you've got to, and to get your stars, you've got to be either first class on a rifle and second on a automatic, or first on an automatic and second on a rifle.
So which rifle company did you go into?
B Company. I went into B Company Rifle, which is the Duke of Wellington, because Strensel at that time was a holding and training unit for the Duke of Wellingtons, the York and Lancs, the Green Howards, the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, the East Yorks, and the West Yorks. That was six different regiments. And they trained them all up, and by the time you'd done your 6 weeks basic training, then you go and onto your continuation training, which goes on to for 10 weeks. And if anything's happening in the world or something, and a battalion's got to go, they draw them. So when it came to moving, the Duke of Wellingtons were on the move to Chisholm Camp down in Wiltshire, up on St George, and I moved down there with them. And as I say, other lads that were in there, they were rebadged to Dukes, like so many in the Royal Northern Fusiliers, some of the East Yorks, some of the West Yorks, and sort of things. But you all became Duke of Wellingtons then, you know. And I think once a battalion was made up to strength, and if they got more than what they needed for any operational purpose and whatnot, if you wanted, I think you could put in a request to revert back to your own regiment that you enlisted with. But I mean, as it was at Strensel, it didn't matter what you were in. You were all in together, and you'd done all the same training. And it's just an infantry holding regiment, you know.
How did you get on in B Company?
I got on very well in B Company. And, of course, the thing was, there's a lot of... it was mostly National Service that was coming in at that time. And, of course, I was a little cocky bugger, wasn't I? Because I was already a soldier before they came in, sort of things, you know. But, you know, you couldn't get away with anything because the old sergeants were Second World War things and the corporals, you know. I mean, they got their ribbons up and sort of things. So you all got treated the same, you know. But then, you know, National Service is the same as the young lads coming in, you know. They just left home and some of them, you know, just break down and sort of thing, and, you know, but I was there, of course, I had a little sort of, well, I wouldn't say I was blackmailing one thing or another, but I'd do a pair of bull boots for 6 months or something like that, or do somebody's blankoing and things like that, you know, but it was the sort of thing that happens in there. I mean, the NCOs, you get the recruits coming, you get all these uniforms that are all creased up and one thing or another, and they all had to be ironed. Well, nobody ever brings an iron with them, but the NCOs have always got two or three in the cupboard, which they'll hire out. So, I mean, if I'm doing a blanket for somebody, the NCOs can grumble at me because they're hiring an iron out for the National Service.
So it was a little business you were running.
Well, it was, but it only goes in so far as the soldiers then find out his routine and can do his own. Once he knows how to do it, you know, I mean, you get some people who get, you can put a belt on and start blankoing it and they've still got the brasses on. I mean, you've got to strip a better thing down because the brasses have to be cleaned and everything and sort of thing. And then if you get them to come to that stage, then they'll be assembling it up and they'll forget that they've got polish on the inside of the brasses, so when they put it on the belt, of course all the blankers got some, you know, it's only until they can do it themselves, then they, you know, and say, oh no, I'll do it my own.
What happened to you after Strensel?
From Strensel we moved down to Chiseldon, a camp just outside Swindon, and it was all huts, and it was a kind of an overgrown sort of thing. The officers' mess and the sergeant's mess were about a mile away from the main part of the camp. And what that consisted of all the time, we'd become a mechanised battalion, which meant